Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we're all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host. He takes a licking and keeps on ticking, Stephen Gordon. How you doing, Stephen?
Hey, I am much better. Thank you, Phil. I have taken the licking, but I'm back, and so I'm feeling better and glad to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you back. It was lonely without you 2 weeks ago, and I'm sure the whole world feels it was lonely without us last week. So.
The whole world.
Well, you know, this show is accessible to everyone. Anyone who has internet access, you know, billions could listen to our program. Also, do want to thank Michael Darling for filling in 2 weeks ago. It was lonely without Stephen, but it was great to have Michael back in the virtual studio, holding down while Stephen was out recuperating. And so, how you feeling now? You're back and ready for action, or are you still a little down under the weather, or what's the prognosis?
Well, I'm feeling great, and which is very important. Last week, whatever hit me like a freight train, and I was in bad shape. But I feel great, but I'm going to try to keep from disintegrating into a coughing fit before the show's over. Got the cough drops here and the coffee standing by, so I think we can get through it.
Okay. It's fine. I never noticed that coffee has the word cough in it. Sorry.
Well, happy Groundhog Day, by the way.
Free association. Hey, happy Groundhog Day. I understand that my namesake up there in Punxsutawney did, in fact, see his shadow, and therefore, we are in for another 6 weeks of winter. For those not familiar with the tradition, every year, actually, it's not just this one groundhog. I mean, the way it's supposed to work, I believe, is the groundhog comes out of his hole, and if he sees his shadow, he's frightened by it, goes back into his hole, and thus winter will be around for 6 more weeks. If he does not see a shadow, then he stays out, and through whatever groundhog magic, I don't know, then we only get 2 more weeks of winter. Is that your understanding, Stephen?
Well, what happens is these guys in top hats or whatever, they knock on Bill's
little Well, no, that's what goes on in Punxsutawney, but I'm talking about the original, you know.
The original deal, yeah.
Story.
That's my understanding. But nowadays, the way we handle it is they bring him out of his little house, and this one guy who claims to know groundhoggies, has a little conversation with Phil, and Phil lets him know what the deal is. And so
there you go.
That's apparently how they handle it. Is it Gobbler's Knob, or what's the name of that?
Gobbler's Knob is is the location actually outside of Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, where the event actually occurs. I guess it's a little common area, a little bit outside of town, although in the movie it's portrayed as though that's like the town square or something like that. Apparently that's not the case. It's a little rural area somewhere near the town. And, that's where they have this elaborate ceremony with the guys in the top hats and formally dressed, and they bring out the groundhog. They chat with him, and then he tells them what the future is going to be, whether spring is going to be with us immediately or whether it will be in 6 weeks. So, in fact, yeah, I guess the groundhog has kind of evolved.
That's
what happened over time. He's become more sophisticated. Now, we're all familiar, or most of us who are familiar with the whole ceremony, are familiar because of the 1993 movie called Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray, in which...
Great movie, by the way.
Terrific movie, in which the whole thing is acted out. In fact, it's acted out repeatedly, because this is a spoiler for anyone who has managed to get through the last 16 years without seeing Groundhog Day. The movie is about a guy who's stuck reliving the same day, day after day after day. And it's interesting that I see in the chat room already they're talking about things repeating time after time, even before I had mentioned the movie Groundhog Day, that the term Groundhog Day now refers not only to this day, the 2nd of February, wherein we look for the groundhog to predict whether we're going to have an early spring or six more weeks of winter, but it's also come to mean in most people's mind this this experience of living the same day over and over, or something repeating over and over.
Getting caught in a loop of some sort.
That's it, exactly. He gets caught in a loop. Bill Murray plays the, I think he's a weatherman from Pittsburgh, also named Phil. So a lot of Phils in this movie, who I guess is on assignment to go down to the town where the prediction is made every year. He considers it beneath his dignity. He wants to be a big city weatherman. He's not a very likable person. And somehow he gets through the day. Then there's a blizzard and he can't get back to Pittsburgh, so he has to spend the night there. Gets up the next morning, and it's Groundhog Day again. leading to one of the great lines of the movie. There's a lot of really wonderful dialogue and great one-liners from Bill Murray, but he's that second day he's there, that second Groundhog Day, when the day has repeated and he can't figure out what's going on, he's trying desperately to get out of town, and he's on the phone and he's explaining that they've got to send emergency help, they've got to, you know, they've got to do something, and you can tell that whoever's on the other end, you can't hear him, but whoever's on the other end says something about they'll do it tomorrow. And he says, "No, you don't understand. What if there is no tomorrow? There wasn't one today." And that pretty much sets the tone for everything that that occurs from then on. And every morning he wakes up, he's in the same place, it's the same day. No one else remembers anything that's happened, but he's having this continuous experience of experiencing the same day over and over and over again. How many times? Any thoughts on that, Stephen? You've seen the movie once or twice, I imagine.
Yeah, I've probably seen it a dozen times, but I don't think they ever really, you know, count it. In fact, you know, at some point in the movie, you know, there's sort of a flash forward as if he's been there another month or two, you know. It's not like they show every single repeat that he's experienced. And, you know, they show him learning to play the piano, because at least that's something different, you know. As he repeats the day over and over, he learns the piano and he learns these other skills and things while he's stuck in this day. So,
which tells me it had to be hundreds of times, maybe thousands of times. He might have spent years in that one day. I mean, realistically, not that you have to be realistic in a movie that's fantasy, but he went from no piano skills to, you know, in the end, he's jamming with the band, right? He's not only playing classical music from memory, he's improvising and just playing whatever comes to mind. He goes from apparently not speaking French at all to reading French poetry for pleasure, right? So there's this amazing transformation that takes place, and it could only really be accounted for if he was in there for a very, very long time, longer than I think we would care to repeat the same day. Because really, the idea of doing that is pretty horrifying when you think about it. I mean, to wake up in the morning and know that that you're experiencing continuity and no one else is, right? That the day will disappear to everyone else around you, and you'll wake up with with the reset button. There's almost kind of a mythological feel to it. It's like one of the punishments that the ancient Greek gods might have laid out on somebody, right? To have them kind of stuck in the same day, looping through the same day. But what I love about Groundhog Day, in addition to the fact that I think it's a very funny movie, I think it's one of Bill Murray's best movies, is that it says something kind of profound in its own way. Ostensibly, this is a romantic comedy, but it says something kind of profound about waiting for the future. Here's a guy who cannot get to tomorrow. You know, we all feel like we have a hard time getting to wherever it is we're trying to get in life. And for us as futurists, sometimes we become impatient for the changes that we're hoping to see, for the things that we're hoping that will happen one day. And there's really no reason to be impatient for us because it seems like things are happening so fast. But, you know, there are certain things, flying cars, you know, life extension, certain things that it perpetually seem to be out there, out of reach. You can't get to them, and you keep cycling through and you never get to them. And then one amazing day, he wakes up, and the music playing on the radio is not what he's heard every single day. And there's someone else in the room with him, and there's this other great line. He says, well, that's different. And what's her name? Andy McDowell. I can't remember what she says, but then he says, any change is good, right?
Well,
because
you know,
anything
was funny actually was that the music that came on the radio was the same. And you remember the disc jockey apologized, oh, we did that song yesterday.
You're right, it was the same, but it was in a different place.
Yeah, yeah.
So for those who are, you're absolutely right. But if you're watching closely, if you're paying close attention, it was in a different place. But then immediately when the disc jockeys start talking, you know that something's up. But good call. It was in fact, I Got You, Babe by Sonny and Cher. So he says, any change is good. And it all occurs to him. He starts to cry, and he says, it's here. Today is tomorrow.
Yeah,
and
tomorrow finally came.
It finally came. And here's the interesting thing, Stephen, not to put you on the spot, but can you identify what made that happen? And I don't think we're ever told, so any answer
to
that?
No, they you know, he tries a number of different things. He figures, you know, I've not been a good person, and so I will try to make it a perfect day for his love interest, who is played by Andy McDowell, is that her name?
I think so, yeah.
I forget what her name was in that movie, but anyway. And so he tries to make it the perfect day for her, and then he tries to get her to fall in love with him. And, you know, initially it was, you know, just try to get her in bed, you know. But then he tries to get her to fall in love with him, and then on and on. And, I think that the key finally was that he finally learned to stop being selfish and to think of others. I think that was the key that was given in the movie. But what do you think it was?
Well, it certainly feels that way. I mean, although I get the impression that he does an awful lot of selfless things, having repeated that day a lot of times before it finally kicks in. And speaking as a futurist who gets to interpret the movie any way he wants to, especially since, you know, my name is Phil, I feel like I have special insight here. I think he finally got the present right. And
yeah,
when he was able to manage the present correctly, when he was able to live today correctly, then the future could come. And that, I think, is our takeaway from the movie Groundhog Day and from Groundhog Day. You know, it's a very optimistic holiday when you think about it, because what's the worst thing that can happen on Groundhog Day? Well, in February 2nd, you can be 6 weeks away from the beginning of spring, which, of course, you are anyway, right? So, you know, Groundhog Day, it's a pretty benign, pretty optimistic holiday. And I think there's something to be said for, well, we might have 2 weeks of winter, we might have 6 weeks of winter, but let's get what we're doing right now right. Let's get it right, and then the future can come. Then we'll be ready for tomorrow.
Did you catch that story about PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, wanting to get Punxsutawney Phil replaced with a robot?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, you know, I mean, once again, no one's job is safe, huh?
I think, you know, obviously they are an animal rights group, and, you know, they're entitled to their opinions on things. But to me, if animals have no, you know, I don't know, position in society at all, if they have no, you know, nothing that they can do to either, you know, entertain or be pets to us, or are a resource in some way to this society, then they become endangered at that point. I That's just my two cents on it. And, I think old Phil needs his job. Leave
there it is. Once again, I think everyone's job's at risk from being replaced by a robot. So, join the club, Phil. But I like what the one guy
animatronic said. Phil just wouldn't be as cool, I don't think. So
a little robot comes out and tells you what's going to happen. The one guy in Pennsylvania who said, look, he's treated better than the average child in Pennsylvania. If that was supposed to be a big defense, I don't think that came out the way he intended. But, yeah, it looks to me like he's a very domesticated groundhog. From the photo that we put on the site, it looks to me like he's enjoying it. Humans and animals interact sometimes. You know, we form relationships with animals. We do things with them. Unlike the line when Bill Murray's near bottom in the movie and he talks about how the holiday's really gone downhill because back in the day they used to take him out, they used to kill him, they used to roast him and eat him, right? They don't mistreat the groundhog. I think that's pretty ridiculous. And I think his job will be automated long after the rest of us are have already been replaced by our robot overlords. I predict they'll be doing Groundhog Day with a real live groundhog for a long time to come. At least I hope.
So you think the guy in the top hat might be a robot before Phil is replaced?
I think that's entirely possible. Yeah. That's
okay.
A good way to put it. Yeah. I think he'll be replaced by a robot probably before Phil is. Good call. All right, well, what else we got to talk about this evening? I should just say that in honor of Punxsutawney Phil, we are going to spend this evening just making general prognostications of our own about good things likely to happen, beginning of spring and otherwise. So with that in mind, Stephen, what do you got?
Well, I just wanted to mention desktop manufacturing real quick. This is a subject that's been of interest to us and me particularly since as long as I've been writing for The Speculist. We call them Fab Labs, or Rep Wraps, or any number of things, but 3D printing, where you have a design in your computer and you have this printer that can print 3D objects, and you have a factory in your home, a little factory in your home, and you can produce just anything you can think of or anything someone else has thought of, and you download their design, bang, you've got it. It has the potential of changing the world, and so I found that subject very interesting over the years. And blurb on it that I caught in involving a new magazine called I believe it's Makers, or actually huh? Make. It's Make.
Okay, close.
And they're advertising this magazine, and Boing Boing picked it up, and they have this little YouTube video over there, and I highly recommend checking that out because you get the feel of what the hobby now. Now it is a hobby. This is
right.
These are dedicated guys, not unlike I would think the folks that were the hobbyists back in the 70s with personal computers.
Right.
These guys are cut from much the same mold, coming up with their own new designs. They're coming up with scanners that can be built. They've got 3D printers now that you buy the kit for. It costs you about $1,000, and then you build your 3D printer. That's not unlike what the first Apple computer was. Where you bought the Apple computer, and then they sent you the components, and you put it together in a wood cabinet that you would build yourself,
Right.
That was
the Apple
that's
One.
That's kind
it
of the state of 3D printing right now, and it's got a long way to go. But, if you're interested in getting in on the hobby at the ground floor, this is the time, So I recommend it. I just put a link in the chat room and also have it in the show notes later.
Well, I think it's really exciting to see that transition occurring. And I wrote about this, probably about a month ago, I guess. The origin of so much of what we take for granted in the world today actually goes back to something called the Homebrew Computer Club, which was a Silicon Valley group of hobbyists that got together every week and were doing a lot of the same stuff that you see this new group doing. And before that, the one that really sounds completely implausible, and you would have a hard time believing that it has anything to do with the world we live in today, is the MIT Tech Model Railroad Club. But those guys were the original hackers, right? They just they started out hacking railroad systems and then got interested in more elaborate systems, got interested in the phone network. And then, man, when computers got brought on campus, they were all over that, let me tell you. And it was this Model Railroad Club that actually led to the field of artificial intelligence as we know it. The Homebrew Computer Club, you can draw lines. I mean, it's not the absolute origin of, but you can draw very strong connective lines between Apple Computer and Microsoft back to that organization. So it's really no exaggeration to say that a lot of, you know, what you and I are doing right now, everyone in the chat room who's working on a laptop or any other kind of small, you know, microcomputer device, was driven by the efforts of these hobbyists. In one case, a group of hobbyists back in the late 50s and early 60s, and the other case, a group that started up, I think, in the mid 70s. I second your vote that. That anyone who wants to be part of something hugely transitional and transformational for our world, check this out. I provided a link to there's a wiki for those who are interested in learning more about the field and getting started, and I would suggest following the link to Boing Boing and reading up on this magazine too. I'm really thinking, $1,000 is a little pricey, but when you can get your own printer for a 3D printer for, I'm going to say $500. When it hits that price point, I'm going to get one and I'm going to start doing this. Although looking at the Boing Boing article, I'm thinking, man, I got to get one now so I can build my own reaction timer, padded swords, magic photo cube, ESP tester, gourd lanterns, geared candle holder, snow gun, and it says, and tons more. So you buy this, you get this magazine, you get all these plans for things you can print out and actual physical objects that you can make. That's really quite amazing.
One of the things that the guys seem to enjoy doing a lot is they make little busts of themselves, basically their heads, you know.
Right.
And you know, for various things, one guy was using his head as a pencil holder, you know, and stuff. But those guys are obviously having a lot of fun with it. There's also another group to look into if this is of interest to you, and that's the RepRap folks.
Yep.
That are actually building 3D printers with the idea that the printer itself can make its own parts. So basically at that point, you know, if you can have a printer that can print itself, then, you know, the price obviously drops quickly from $1,000 a unit or whatever to something, you know, virtually free with, you know, a few parts loaned in. So that you can't print. So that's the idea with the RepRap people, and they're making progress too. So
exciting stuff! It's fun to see this happen, and it's interesting to note that the name of the magazine is Make. We see a link for it, article about it on Boing Boing, which of course Cory Doctorow is one of the editors of Boing Boing, and he is also the author of the novel Makers, which talks about a near future in which, among other interesting things that are happening, increasingly the economy becomes driven by individuals having exactly this capability to make stuff. And I wrote in my blog post, I couldn't help but notice there is a very similar feel and sound and look and spelling to the word maker as there is to the word hacker. And Stephen Levy wrote a really seminal book about the history of the beginnings of the computer revolution called Hackers, which is how I know about the Homebrew Computer Club and the Tech Model Railroad. Those stories are all told in great detail there. And in a sense, although it's not nonfiction, it's science fiction, Makers is almost kind of a sequel to that. And I feel like Cory Doctorow is kind of...
Well, I need to throw out this as a prequel. I read an interesting account. It must have been about 4 or 5 years ago, of guys that, you know, these are all young men. Nerds always tend to be, don't they?
They
tend to be that way.
Well, present company excluded, but we're geeks, actually, not nerds.
Yeah, that's right. We've graduated to geekdom. But anyway, these guys back in the 1890s becoming, you know, fascinated and you know, working all these tricks with phone routers, the first phone routers and things like that back in the 1890s.
Oh, wow.
And so, yeah, I mean, hacking has a long and storied tradition, and so I think the latest iteration now, we're seeing it with the 3D printing.
You know, those relays that were developed for the phone network back in the day, you could have actually built, like, a really big computer with those. I don't know how far those guys got, but that actually would have been possible. That's really interesting. It's noted here by Sally in the comments that Americans have been do-it-yourselfer since pioneer days, but we're becoming much more high-tech do-it-yourselfers. I think that's exactly right. That's what you see. That's what you saw happening with these hobbyists back in the 19th century. That's what you saw with the tech model guys who got really excited when a computer showed up, and that's what you saw when Apple I came along and people started building their own computers, and that's exactly what you're seeing now with these very early stages of people beginning to produce material goods on their own desktops. It's a profound, amazing change that's occurring, and it's happening kind of subtly, and I think people will look back on this as being something much more important than I think it's taken for by most of the world today, which has no notice of it at all.
Well, and the reason is, I mean, primarily what they're producing is little plastic trinkets, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
But think about it. What was Japan producing in the 1950s?
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, at
little
best.
Little plastic trinkets.
Trinkets, yep.
But pretty soon, by the 1980s, of course, they were dominating in electronics. And so, we may see very much the same occurring with 3D printing. They're making nothing of any real value except to the hobbyists themselves. They're doing, making stuff just because they can, and they're learning how to use it. But, you know, when you start being able to print electronics right inside of the unit, all of a sudden it gets real and gets real important very quickly. So that's going to happen.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think we're going to see amazing stuff with that. And once again, I do intend to get one. I want the price point to go down just a little bit first. Okay, so speaking of the price point, I was going to talk about the iPad, but before we go there, let's talk a little bit about the recent announcement that the Constellation Moon Mission Program has been canceled. I assume you've been following that news?
A little bit, yeah. You know, I don't know how to feel about it, to be quite honest, Phil, because on one hand, we have not really, as a people, and I'm talking about humanity now, has not been to the moon since the mid-70s, mid to early 70s.
Yep.
And it seems like, in some ways, it was a huge loss that we backed away so far from the moon and those great heights that we went to, and we had this opportunity to go back, and we were taking it, and we were getting geared up for it, and getting excited about it, and now it appears like that's not going to happen. So that's for that reason, it's a bummer.
Right.
But in another way, there could be some positives to it.
Such as.
What if NASA begins to take on the role that many have thought that it should have had for years, is a facilitator for private space ventures?
Is that not exactly the role that the Obama administration is articulating for NASA,
yeah,
vis-a-vis the space program at this point? So,
and I find myself in rare agreement. So in some ways, it seems like we need, instead of just having one way of getting into outer space, we need, 50 ways to get into outer space. If we have, basically, instead of sending a man to plant a flag on Mars, NASA should be making it possible for the National Geographic Society to go to Mars and to study, things like that. So, I mean, that's, if we can start, basically outsourcing space to the private sector, I think that can only be a good thing.
I actually agree. I and like you, I'm of two minds about this, because on the one hand, the idea of another mission to the moon and a new Apollo-like program was very exciting. And even the patch, the Constellation patch, I thought was cool. It was one of the coolest NASA patches they've come up with in a while. But, you know, that's not that huge of a loss, really, I guess, in the grand scheme of things. But the thing is, we've been there, we've done that. We had Apollo, and I think Apollo did what it needed to do, and Apollo had flaws around where it could go next. So doing that again is probably not a great idea. See, I think that the only way you could go wrong with changing the space program would have been to move ahead with this basic thing. If the president had come and said, "Oh, we're going to do a much, much bigger, much more ambitious space program. You know, we're going to set an Apollo-like goal, get a person to Mars. You know, get a working space city or something like that going." I'd have been all for that. I think plodding along like this, I'm not for that. I think saying, "Nope, we're done. It's time for the private sector to take over." I like that, right? One or the other, right? Let's not futz around in the middle. Either we're gonna have a big program that does something big, something really audacious, or we're saying that that's no longer the domain of government and the private sector is going to take that over. And that's what apparently that's what the Obama administration is saying. And you know, I think that's probably the best way forward. Let's see what happens next. Now I do see.
I love what Ken says here in the chat room. So let's get it on with the space elevator. Let's get on with that. So I think that's a great point. Let's do that. That's the sort of project that would facilitate, you know, actually getting into the outer space.
Absolutely. And if NASA or the government wanted to do that, that would be kind of like them digging the Panama Canal, right? I mean,
exactly.
It's like, okay, well, I can sort of see that. But as far as flying rockets, if the private sector wants to take over, yeah, why not? The private sector flies airplanes, right? So I think we're at that point now. So we'll see. We'll see what happens next. But I think that as with the song being in a different place and someone else being in the room, where the space program is concerned, any change is good. I think they could have gone either way, and it probably would have been a good thing. And so I'm very optimistic about what we see happen next.
Good. Yeah, me too.
Now, Felix in the chat room is predicting that the Chinese and Indians are going to land on the moon, and we're going to whine that we did it back in 69.
Been there, done that, but the truth of the matter is the moon belongs to whoever is actually there. It doesn't matter
right. Who
did it first in the ultimate scheme of things.
The Chinese are well on their way to sending somebody to the moon. They're skipping steps, actually, and they're making tremendous progress, and they could probably have somebody there in 10 years, maybe
whoever
5.
Learn to live off the land. You know, if you got somebody there that's, you know, lands there, sets up a base, is using ice water that they find in the craters to make oxygen and hydrogen for fuel, and they're harvesting the helium-3 to make fusion reactors. You know, when you're at that point and you're there permanently, that's when the moon becomes real, as far as I'm concerned. Until then, we're just planting flags.
Yeah, absolutely, and. It has yet to be seen what the correct set of incentives and economic factors and social factors and everything else that it's going to take to push us to that point. But I don't think that anything like the Constellation program is going to get us anywhere close to what you just described.
Yeah.
So we're better off without it. And let's try.
Maybe so.
Let's try something else. Although it is a cool patch. I hope. I hope they keep the patch. Okay, so let's talk. It's your turn to pick. What next, Stephen?
Well, let me just throw out this as a totally upbeat story that there's no downside to at all.
Okay, go.
Spray on liquid glass, this new nano product that's set to revolutionize the materials industry, and basically products of all sorts are going to start getting this coating of 100 nanometer thick liquid glass.
Okay, so when we say it's liquid glass, is it really glass? It's really, what is glass?
Real glass,
right? Yeah.
It's real glass, but the thing about glass that's only 100 nanometers thick is that it's flexible and breathable. It you know, you put it on something and you hardly even know, you wouldn't be able to tell a difference in the texture really. So
it's not like you're going to coat something with glass and then it's going to shatter.
Exactly. You wouldn't. I mean, you'd look at it and it would look exactly the same.
Huh.
But the thing is, it's bacteria resistant on a permanent basis. It's like being able to, you know, it's like, you know, spraying the doorknobs of your house because, you know, you're having to constantly guard against flu and cold bacteria and things like that. Well, if you have liquid glass on your doorknobs and on your coffee table and on all, you know, probably make carpet with the stuff in it, all of a sudden, bacteria's ability to grow within your home or within your, you know, your office or car or anywhere in your environment is limited on a permanent basis. And so this for health reasons, is a huge deal. But it also, I mean, makes products more durable and, you know, to even acid or, you know, it's like resistant to all kinds of product things that can keep it, you know, it'll keep things from wearing out in a variety of ways. And so they're looking at it as one of the really big first nanomaterials that's going to really revolutionize things.
That sounds very cool. I'm intrigued. Is there some chemical agent that is present when it's being sprayed on and it's adhering that then goes away? I mean, what makes it stick once it's sprayed onto something?
According to this article, there is a quantum effect that makes it hold on in place. I don't pretend to know.
Okay.
Well, understand that, but
quantum effect's a great answer. In fact, if you don't know, that's always a good one to throw
but
in.
Yeah,
right?
Say something like that, and that's a sort of that's
a quantum effect. What do you want from me?
Yeah. Well, anyway, I put the link, and anybody who's interested, check out that link I just put in the chat room and the show notes later.
All right. Well, very exciting. Looking forward to spraying glass onto all our doorknobs and other potential. It'd be cool. Like you could turn your wood top desk into a glass wood top desk, right? Yeah, just
right.
Everything becomes a lot cleaner, a lot more sanitary, and what a cool technology. All right, well, let's move on. We've got lots of great.
I could have done with that in my house a few weeks ago to keep them.
Well, there you go. See, now if those doorknobs
would not have
been
last week had I had liquid glass in my house. So
we might have had a show. There it is.
There you go.
You know, look the immense effect on human history, right there.
Exactly.
So,
there you go.
Dang, just sit back and think about that for a minute. But speaking of things, oh, here's a nice transition. Here's a segue for you. Speaking of things with an immense impact on human history, we got the iPad. The iPad has arrived. And I don't know if you saw the Grammys the other night by any chance?
No, I don't typically catch that.
Okay, well, I usually don't either. I don't know for whatever reason.
I'm not much of an old fuddy-duddy by this point.
We had it on. Well, actually, I was kind of interested, and my wife is very much interested in what women are wearing. So, anyway, Stephen Colbert comes out and does a monologue at the beginning, and he's offering various congratulations around. It's a pretty funny, speech and a good start. And he reaches the end of his speech, and he says, "Well, enough of that. Enough of this. Let's stop congratulating each other, and let's start giving each other awards." And he says, the nominees for the, oh, what, and I can't remember what the category was. It was like Song of the Year or something. They start off with a big prize, big award. He says, the nominees, what are those again? Oh, wait, I have it here. And he reaches into his bag on my iPad. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. He reads them off from his iPad. And it was really great because he calls out Jay-Z, the rap singer, sitting in the front row. And he goes, what, didn't you get one in your gift bag?
That's awesome.
That was hilarious.
I love that.
But so here we have it. It's the return of the what do we call this? The return of the future of the computer,
tablet.
Right? Because we've heard this one before, right? We've been down this road before.
There's this whole thing. There's like a slideshow on the internet called the long fail of the tablet computer. You know, I mean, it's just. Over and over and over again, there have been efforts to make tablet computers work in the marketplace, and each and every time, it just hasn't been It just hasn't worked. I guess most famously is the Newton, but I mean, there's probably been 24 others that have tried and failed. So anyway, I wish them the best. But it's funny, College Humor, that website, they have jumped all over this thing. It's just, they have this, hilarious video where these guys are like coming on, and they're like, they've introduced themselves as comedy writers, and they're just breathless with anticipation of the iPad, They say, when a product comes along that appears so stupid that the ways that you can make fun of it are practically endless, it actually becomes magical. The range of jokes we can make about the iPad are as wide as this useless piece of crap is itself, So, anyway, it's funny because, that said, and folks are going to make fun of the iPad. I mean, it's even the name is not particularly great, is it? But the thing is, I think it'll find the market. There's, we have iPhones that have all these apps that we love and everything, but the iPad obviously will have all of those apps from the very beginning. I think there's like 60,000 of them, at least a couple of thousand of which are actually pretty good. So, so you have that built-in, usefulness already with that, and it'll be, its size allows it to be a better reader and a better, viewer of video and things like that. So I think, there's actually, we laugh about it, but I think there's actually a use for it. And I think this may actually be the tablet that breaks through. So, I throw that out there as sort of a bone to those who may actually be anticipating this.
There's a lot of different ways of dissecting this, and there's a lot of different ways of interpreting what's happening now and where this thing is going to go. One of the interesting things about the Newton is the Newton failed primarily because there wasn't really much you could run on the Newton. It was a great PDA for its time. And I had a colleague, a woman I worked with, I think as late as 2002, 2003, she was still hanging on to her Newton because she loved it so much.
Funny.
Useless. It wouldn't sync with anything. I mean, it was just, but
she had come to like it and was just not giving it up easy.
It had engendered some real loyalty with a few folks. And I think the lesson that got carried to the iPhone is that you got to have software, you got to have stuff to do with the device, right? So the iPhone became this very successful platform, not so much as a phone as we've discussed, but as a computer. And I'll tell you, as a computer, what I keep thinking about whenever I use my iPhone is, I wouldn't mind it being about three times the size, okay? I would really be fine with that. So I think just from a standpoint of people doing computery things in this very small space who like the interface but who would like something bigger, I think there's a potential niche there. Now there's the other way of looking at this, which says, well, I don't know, Jobs has had a pretty good run, right? He hasn't had something really epic fail on him since...
Newton, probably.
Maybe the Newton. There was the Tower Mac. There was the Power PC. I mean, there were there were a few things in there, but it's been a while, right? So he could be due.
He might be due a real big, huge, embarrassing failure. But I don't know that this will be it. It's it was funny that in the College Humor guys were saying, do we call it the iPod Jumbo or do we call the iPhone the iPad Nano? I think there's actually probably a market for it. Now, to me, they should have made it to where it would make calls. If it's just a big, huge phone too, there might actually that would help, I think. But they did not fix it that way, and there's also no camera. But I guess people feel silly holding out that big thing as a camera. But any rate, it'll be fun to watch, regardless of whether it completely fails or if it succeeds magnificently. it'll be fun to watch it. So.
Well, they can always add the make a call capability. I think what they're trying to do is not they want to make it succeed without making the iPhone fail, right? I think that was probably the idea, but behind not having it make calls. But that was, you know, if that's the case, why did you make the iPhone able to play iTunes? Why did you make the iPhone an iPod, right?
Yeah.
So they're not necessarily employing the same strategies with each new device, and maybe that's right. You know, these people have obviously given this some thought. I think it would be a mistake to think that we're raising these issues for the first time. That this hasn't been that they haven't gone round and around and around with this stuff in Cupertino. But I read a really interesting article on Business Insider site on the Silicon Valley Insider, and this guy, Henry Blodgett, writes, "We've seen the amazing future of Apple's iPad, and this is it." And he starts out and he talks about why the initial reception of this thing has really fallen flat. But he talks about two things that you really have to look at when you look at the future of this device, and he says the one is the price, and then the other is the way in which it's likely to be used, which is fundamentally different from both how computers and mobile gadgets are used. And he talks about, the full, if you go out and buy one right now, it's like $829, right?
Actually, there's four different potential. Actually, I'm sorry. There's six different pricings, because you can buy, it's amazing, you can buy the Wi-Fi only tablet in 16 gigabyte versions, 32 gigabyte versions, and 64 gigabyte versions for three different prices, and then you can buy the iPad that's both Wi-Fi and 3G in, you know, 16 gigabyte, 32 gigabyte, and 64 gigabyte models. So you got six different models are rolling out all at the same time with six different prices.
Yeah, well, that's not atypical of Apple, but I think the bottom line, the entry level entry price is $499 right now.
That's the cheapest one.
16 gig Wi-Fi only. Right. Yeah, so you get no service plan,
right.
Nothing. Okay, $499. So he writes, if iPad prices follow the trend of iPod, iPhone, and other gadget prices, we should be able to buy the low-end version for $299 in 2 years and $199 in 3 years. At $199, the whole game changes. Why? Because of the way the iPad is likely to be used. On stage on Wednesday, Steve Jobs demonstrated the primary use case for the iPad, puttering around the house. Note that he did not demonstrate the iPad by walking around the stage or working at a desk. He did not play up its productivity benefits, which are the sales pitch for most PCs and laptops, nor its communications benefits, which is the sales pitch for most mobile computing gadgets. Steve focused on something different, media consumption and entertainment for the home. And he goes on to write, he says, in 3 years, when the low-end Wi-Fi-powered iPad costs $199, many households will buy three or four of them and just leave them lying around the house. These iPads won't be owned by any one member of the household the way PCs and cell phones are. They won't live on desks the way desktops do, and they won't be carried everywhere the way mobile phones are. They'll just be there around the house on tables and counters the way today's books, magazines, games, and newspapers are, booted up, ready to use. And then he goes on and continues to give that scenario. Now, that is an interesting picture of the use of this technology, and I have to say that I've got two laptops in my house that are almost sort of becoming that, right? They're just kind of around, and if you need it, it's there, right? I mean, one of them is actually my laptop, but it gets used by different people in the house, and because of Wi-Fi, it gets left lying around. And so I can see people potentially doing this. It's like, well, you have, you know, one or two TVs around your house, you're probably going to have two or three iPads around so people can read magazines or whatever it is they want to do. What do you think? How do you respond to that scenario, Stephen?
I think that's definitely how it'll be used. This is not a productivity device. I can't imagine anybody sitting there trying to type in something, you know, like a lengthy paper or something with this device. You know, you just don't use a touchscreen for that. That's just not how it'll be used at all. But, you know, you could play games with it. My iPhone I enjoy very much a game called Let's Golf, and so you know it's a little golfing game, and you know, other games like SimCity and Wolfenstein 3D and other things have had successful ports over to the iPhone. I think, you know, it would be very easy to make some very good-looking games that would be fun to play on it. Then you have movies that would, you know, you could stream through Netflix or some other service like that that would work well with that device, and also people will read with it. Now, it's not as easy on the eyes as electronic ink is, and I think that while this is probably, this device is probably disturbing Amazon quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Their Kindle is, you know, in some ways it's safe because, you know, when it comes time to read a long book, electronic ink is just going to be so much easier on your eyes than the screen is. But Jobs is obviously banking on it being used as a book reader because he rolled out the same day as the iPad. He rolled out this iBookstore.
Right.
And so that's he's looking to sell books that way through that, using a similar model, I think, to what he's done with iTunes.
Now, it'll be interesting to see whether there will be a Kindle app running on the iPad.
Well, there's already a Kindle app for iPhones, and since the iPad is supposedly able to run all the Kindle app, all of the apps that the iPhone runs, you have to ask somebody that already has an iPad, but I would think that it's you could already use it as a Kindle device.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. So the upside for Amazon is people are going to be buying books from them anyway, right? I mean, if they buy them through the iPad store, maybe not, but if they buy a Kindle book off their iPad, well, Amazon really is only primarily selling the Kindle because they want to sell the electronic books, not so much because they care about being in the hardware business. So that can potentially work out okay for them anyhow.
Right.
But we'll see. Anyway, I love that picture of the future of just having a few iPads lying around the house or something similar. And I really look forward to – I think I've mentioned that I'm completely addicted to iPhone Scrabble.
Oh, yeah. Me as well. So
yeah.
Perhaps,
I love that game. But my fingers are just a little.
We need to play sometime, Phil.
Yeah, we should get a game going. Absolutely. I get tired of losing to the computer all the time. I want to lose to an actual human being. My fingers are just a little too big to move those squares once they're on the little. You know, I keep thinking, man, a slightly bigger display. But it'd be fun. You could take that iPad down, and two people could actually sit across the table, and they could play it'd be like a real game of Scrabble.
Yeah.
Or maybe two people could play the computer. You know, all kinds of possibilities.
Absolutely, it's going to be fun to watch. It'll be something that I think that people will, you know, some folks are going to get an iPad just for the irony of it. You know, just to be able to walk around and say, you know, be able to pull it out as something that's so completely uncool that it's funny. You know,
right?
But then, you know, if it really is useful enough, I think it'll jump that valley and it'll be able to. It actually might. Charge past the uncoolness to actually become cool. So we'll see. It'll be fun to watch.
We shall see. All right, Stephen, last story of the day. What's it going to be?
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about this development in Fusion. Let's see if I can get to the article real quick. It's what is happening, apparently, is this. There is a milestone that the guys in Fusion Research have been pushing towards for probably 40 or 50 years. And we just came a lot closer to it within the last month. And the milestone is called fusion ignition. It's the point at which they're able to actually have controlled fusion, which is the power of the sun, within a reactor. Okay, now, once they reach fusion ignition, they're still saying, well, it could still be years, maybe even decades, from the point of fusion ignition to the point that we have a useful power-generating, you know, fusion device. But the idea, though, is once we are able to have fusion ignition, then one of the big technical hurdles will be behind us, and then they'll look at it as just a matter of tweaking it. And at that point, we know it's possible. We can get there. It's just a matter of doing the basic research to get it done. But anyway, so part of the problem apparently with fusion is that you can't see what's going on in order to do the tweaks you need to do. So in other words, you know, imagine trying to build a car with a blindfold for the first time, never having built a car before, and no one ever having built a car before. You know,
yeah, you're not quite sure what a car is. Yeah.
Yeah, don't know what a car is exactly. We have this idea that it's a horseless carriage. It's a carriage that'll move on its own. And so let's put a blindfold on and try to figure it out. Well, if you can't see what you're doing, then obviously the job becomes, you know, exponentially harder. So what has happened here is that they got one fusion reaction within one chamber, and then they created another fusion reaction behind it, basically to backlight what was going on within the device so that they can figure out what in the world's happening there so that they can tweaks. And so that's what's happened, and they're very excited about it. Now they're talking about, you know, for first time ever, they're talking instead of them in terms of decades to the point that we get to fusion ignition. They're saying, we all have, now that we've been able to do this and we're seeing what we're doing, we're talking, you know, within the next year or so, we'll have fusion ignition. And so that's, to me, that's pretty exciting. And that's MIT news, and I'll go ahead and put that in the chat room as well.
Absolutely. That's great. Now, question about the model they're using. Is that the tokamak model of fusion we're talking about, or is that Boussard electrostatic, whatever that's called, fusion, or do you know? Or is it something else?
I do not know, and the article does not say if this is the big boys that are doing it with the 30 years from now model, or if this is the smaller group, but it's researchers at MIT's Plasma Science and Fusion Center.
Huh,
I don't know
okay.
what exactly they're doing there, but it's they're very excited about it, and I put the link there so you guys check it out.
Well, I think it's extremely exciting, and the thing is, even for the tokamak model, that's the one that we don't spend as much time talking about. We've been pretty excited about Boussard fusion and other possible models of fusion that have kind of come to the fore here in the last few years. But the reason, my understanding, the traditional model for fusion remains perpetually 30 years in the future is it's so darn hard to light the fuse, right? This is actually the problem. This is the thing that they've never been able to do. And if they figured out how to do this, we could very well be looking at a whole new ballgame.
That's right. Now that they can see what they're doing, maybe it'll be a benefit to both programs. Maybe this is something that the Boussard folks need as well as the tokamak folks need. But anyway, it's... So that's an exciting development.
All right. Well, great stuff. Well, fun talking about various predictions for the future this evening, and I see we're already at our time. So what do we got lined up music-wise this evening?
The music is Beautiful Day by Sarah Hayes.
Okay. Well, Beautiful Day. How appropriate for Groundhog Day. Good thinking, Stephen. All right. So we'll listen to...
If you want to hear it in stereo, go to musicalley.com and check them out there. I'll have the link in the show notes.
We'll provide a link to that. It's I'm sorry, was it Sarah Hayes?
That's right.
Sarah Hayes singing Beautiful Day. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. Great to have you back. Great to be back with all of you, and we look forward to being with you again next week on the next Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.
A smile on Mona Lisa's face, a little spare change given to the stranger on the corner, a pile of leaves deep enough for my soul to jump into, and all my doubts fall away and lead me here to say it's a beautiful day. The rain, I can feel the sunshine on my face, not wore my blue jeans and my black t-shirt. And that's just fine, cause every day I know I try to make art not war and let love reign and lead the world to say it's a beautiful day. It's a beautiful day.